The Sky is Ours welcomes you to an episode of Voices of Reality, an interview podcast where we talk about mental health, education systems, feminism, and many other topics. Today we have with us Keshav Tiwari. Keshav Tiwari is a 12th grade student at the Dune School and a good friend of mine. He's an avid debater in both Hindi and English and enjoys writing in both languages as well for various different school publications. Thank you so much for coming to talk to us today, Keshav.
No issues here, Mayank. I think anyone who is a friend of mine, just like you, or just like anyone in my friend circle would know that if there's one thing that I'm extremely enthusiastic about, it's to have conversation and discuss ideas and people. So I think it's all cool. Yeah.
Thank you, Keshav. So let's just get right into the questions. So for the first question, as in school also and outside of school, I know you're involved in a host of different activities. So one thing that is quite an issue for many students, especially in higher grades, is how do you make time for yourself in the middle of this daily routine? And do you feel the self-directed time is very essential to you, or do you just make time out for yourselves in like small gaps between different sessions and all?
So I think that's a very relevant question to ask, because I feel like almost everyone has, like, this is something that I've seen happening throughout our sort of generation, where whenever I ask someone how their day went, so I was like, how was your day? And the person would always reply with something like, oh, I got a lot done today, so it was a good day. Like that sentence, and in defining your day through how productive you were, is such a weird way to describe your day. And I feel like we've gone wrong somewhere, and we've started treating ourselves like machines, where we start describing our days through like productivity. Like, ideally, a good day for me would be having like red velvet waffles and coffee or something like that. So like, you know, I've had a good day, or playing football somewhere. But so to answer your second question first, I think self-directed time is extremely essential for anyone, because self-directed time is sort of like a cure to brain fog and constantly sort of overwhelming yourself with all the activities and all the things that are going on in a particular person's life. And I mean, for me, like as you said in my introduction, I write a lot, I debate a lot, I like in general, I'm involved in a lot of things. So I think the hardest thing to do in such a scenario is to keep track of all that is happening. And once you sort of commit to the idea that, you know, I can't complete everything in one day, the time, self-directed time sort of comes about on its own. So for me, something that I've realized over the past months especially is that procrastination is not, like, the opposite of procrastination isn't productivity. And the opposite to procrastination is simply action. So anything that you, if you're doing something, so it's almost like if you're doing something by the end of it. So if I procrastinate a deadline and I submit it on the last minute, I've still got that done, right? So procrastination isn't the same thing as being lazy. And I think that's what a lot of people sort of consider procrastination as. So I don't think that's fair to say. And once you sort of come around with that concept, you understand that there is a lot of time to be found to, you know, sort of work on yourself. For me, at least, the way that I try and find the things that I do in my self-directed time would be, you know, just going out for a run, or like at times I try and meditate. I'm a big fan of reading, but I can't read books because like it's like I can't. Like, I feel like it's a big commitment. So I read articles and things of that sort. So yeah, that's usually what I do in my self-directed time.
So I definitely agree about the part where you, once you get a mindset in, then it becomes a lot easier for you to find your self-directed time. And I think that's an interesting thought, because when we're talking about the idea that when you're looking for opportunities will find you, I found that to be true more than once I found that to be true many, many times. So I think that would apply the same here also, where as long as you understand that you can't do everything at once, but you should be doing whatever you can, then you start working, chipping away at your tasks one after the other, instead of just like rushing through them or trying to complete them all. So I sat, like, not getting the quality, just trying to get it done with, right? So you mentioned something about the deadlines, right? So like you said, like, submitting right just 1 minute before the deadline, even that could be considered that's considered to be done with the task at hand. However, that is often very, very stressful, right? I've never faced a moment when I'm submitting right before the deadline, even 10 minutes before the deadline. It's been stressful for me because I know I'm almost going to make it. And if I don't make it, then you just feel a little bad. So in your opinion, what challenges does a teenager face in regards to like mental well-being, academic mental well-being and all? You can talk about from personal examples, if that's convenient. You can talk about how your specific curriculum has affected your mental health. So what are your views on that?
That's extremely true. Something that I will just like to point out is that as much as we like to sort of victimize ourselves when it comes to curriculums, that's the wrong word to use, but essentially, like, we often say that, oh, the curriculum is made against us. That's not true. Whenever a curriculum is made, it is often made keeping the sort of mindset that a student will be in at that point of time. So every curriculum is again, it's contextual. And if your curriculum is made like in the 1800s or something, of course, it's not going to be relevant right now, but it does come from a place where it, you know, understands the mindset of a student. However, I do feel that like some curriculums have failed to sort of, you know, upgrade and develop according to the time that has been that has gone by since their inception. Talking about my own curriculum, I belong to the IB diploma program, and for me, I feel like a lot of times, like a junior would come up to me and they'll ask, they'll tell me that, oh, you just have six subjects to focus on, so it's not really that hard, and you have Hindi in your IBDP, so it isn't really a subject, so you really just have five subjects to focus on. The thing that people don't understand with the IBDP, at least, is that there are a lot of extra components that come attached to it, and the fact that ever since our sort of beginning of school, like in like school as in primary, elementary, secondary, like the reason why subjects have reduced from 12 to 10 to 9 to 8 and finally now 6, and in the ISE it's 5. So the reason why we've reached this point is because the subject matter of these subjects increases. And so it's more about specialization at that point of time rather than, you know, trying to figure out what you're sort of more inclined to. And in saying that, the IBDP has six subjects, it has internal assessments, it has exams, then there is a theory of knowledge component where you need to write an essay that is more based on epistemology, which is the study of studying, essentially. Then there is an extended essay where you write a research paper on your particular subject of choice. And essentially, there are a lot of components that come attached with it. And the main sort of issue that I face with regard to my mental well-being is that there is so much going on that it's very hard to keep track of everything. And that is often what overwhelms you, because bear in mind, this is along with all the activities that a person is doing, and in both of our cases, this is along with college applications that are taking place, writing essays, trying to research about colleges, their courses, blah blah. So that's when it becomes extremely overwhelming, to, you know, and it gets very, like, you get very anxious, because no matter, like, it doesn't matter if you cross out the five to-do lists like to-do list elements that you set out for yourself for the day, at the end of the day, you will still feel like there is so much more to do and you could have done much more. And it's just a very, a feeling that is very, like, it leaves you unsatisfied. And that sort of dissatisfaction plays along with the anxiety and is a big challenge that you need to sort of, you know, overcome. And again, we go back to the concept of, you know, acknowledging the fact that there is only so much you can do in a day and trying to not hustle through it, but trying to understand that there is a balanced and perfect and life that you need to maintain, and also that there is a life outside the curriculum that you're in. So yeah, that's sort of what my take is on.
Okay,
that.
So I know I'm also in the same curriculum, so I can say that definitely this is something which you said struck out for me, is that there's a life outside the curriculum. And I think that's something very specific, especially for curriculum such as the IAB, which tries to involve the students practically as much as possible within the curriculum, that you get stuck within it. So all the extracurricular activities, like your debating, like your writing, all those things become things which are not related to the curriculum at all. And I think the whole idea of having these deadlines, having all these projects, means that someone or another is on a different level and you're on a different level. And that comparison also probably increases the stress, because someone might be headed in one thing or someone might be behind in another thing. You don't always know what is happening in the entire process with everyone, or what's happening with you, how do you compare relatively. So I think that adds to the anxious nature of these curriculums as well, especially these international curriculums. But I do feel, would you say that maybe it's a little better, because I had an experience where for a month or two in between, I studied the CBSE curriculum, and what I found was that there, the curriculum is intensely focused on just the academic part of things. So it becomes very difficult that you need to focus your energies always on those things. But in the curriculum such as the IB or international curriculums and place or other curriculums which encourage extracurriculars, you can often like shift your energy to something else if you're not feeling like it. Do you feel that helps the mental well-being part of things? That having the ability to shift your energies to a different component of the curriculum or a different activity which you know will still help you, although not in the same way?
I mean, that's such a good point that you bring in, because yeah, I think that is true, wherein you are not stuck with, you know, highlighting your textbooks all day, because and you can, you know, choose to go to a lab and, you know, do data collection or try and synthesize all the data that you have, write a report, conclusions, introductions and whatnot. But I think in saying that, I think it also heavily depends on what sort of approach a student takes to the curriculum. Like I know the IB, like both of us know that the IB is like the fundamental sort of premise of the IB is the IB learner profile, where they want us to be risk takers, organizers, and to be honest, all of like those sort of buzzwords that are thrown around about, you know, being the ideal student. But often the approach that we take to these components is just, okay, let me get this done and then I can, you know, sort of go on to do whatever I want. Often the mere attachment to the curriculum or the diploma program is makes the thing academic in nature and makes the thing very sort of makes a thing something that you need to do instead of something that you want to do. And I think that's not the culture that the IB wants to promote, and that's not the culture that any curriculum wants to promote, really. I mean, the ISC has their own projects and stuff that they do, and I mean, all of them I think have practicals and all as well in science subjects. So I mean, they don't want students to feel that way, but they're also not helping the students change by remaining the static sort of curriculums that they are. And in a way, that is sort of stagnating the whole education system that we sort of are based on. Like, take for example, like Scandinavian countries like Denmark and whatnot. Like these countries are where, you know, like you wouldn't hear a top 50 university coming from Denmark. Like you'll think about your Harvards, your Princetons, your Stanfords, and whatnot. But a Denmark university is something that people will not seriously consider. And I speak from experience because I'm not considering any like Danish universities in, when it comes to my college applications. And I don't think a lot of people that I know are. But it's just that, and I think that is all, that is based on the premise that we've grown up with curriculums being academic. Like I don't want to use the word academic with like a negative connotation, but that is essentially what we have attached to it. And that's what makes the experience of going through that curriculum so unpleasurable. I mean, and just, and if I could just take the liberty to attach this to your first sort of question, I was thinking about like these things that like, we were talking about, having a life outside the curriculum. I feel like our lives are greatly, are very well simulated by video games. And I think I've given, like, I've talked about this at length in school, but, I feel like, and if you take any open world game, for example, like a Watch Dogs or a GTA, there's always like a mission that you need to do, right? Like there is always this, there's this campaign that you have to complete, and the game ends once that campaign is completed. And in order to get to the end, you need to do certain missions. And in the process of doing those missions, you take some side missions to, you know, like just sort of mix it up, or you play online and stuff. But And that's essentially the like a parallel to you sort of trying to work towards, you know, getting to like attaining happiness essentially in your life. So like essentially your first mission would be, okay, I need to get through high school. Okay, then I need to get through a good college, and then I go through college, I get a job, blah, blah. And that's what takes place. And you take those side missions, like your extracurriculars, and okay, maybe like, and for some people, as sad as it may sound, relationships are often like a side mission. So like we tend to do things, but at times I think it's very important to, you know, just, you know, like try and get into a Mini Cooper and try and see if you can climb up that hill that is in front of you with a Mini Cooper instead of a monster truck. Just trying to experiment with those kind of things. And you do that in an open world game just because you want to do that. But often we don't take the liberty to do those things in our life. So like, especially like, I think in the context of an Indian student, especially, like a lot of us are so sort of college centric or job centric or like almost like a life mission campaign centric that we don't understand that like at times, like it gets boring to just keep on, you know, doing those missions one after the other. And it's extremely important to just try and do things just because you want to do things. So
from what I understand, like you're talking about having this defined set of goals that you need to complete and the way you need to complete, which has often been defined like people around you. And so like, for example, I think you've mentioned that juniors like often come and ask for advice, and like say other people also, family, friends, cousins, they ask for advice, like you've been through the system or you're in the system, what is your advice on this, on how to do this? But what they're asking advice for is essentially advice on how to follow a path which has already been traversed thousands and thousands of times by other people. They want to figure out what's the easiest way to get through that path, but they don't try to, again, like figure out their own way. So like, I know, for example, that most, even though we'll say like I've taken physics, chemistry, math, it's a pretty common combo for someone who's interested in STEM. But then I believe one of our classmates has taken a combination which is a little more unique. It's like history, English, and some other subjects which you normally would not have in a combination. So like just figuring out how to have fun along the way, how to learn, how to push your own limits, your own way. I don't know if that's making any sense, but yeah, push your own limits in your own way. I think that's sort of what you were going for, right?
Yeah. And I think I've been sort of at fault for not doing this often. So like even at the risk of sounding like a person who's a hypocrite, like I was going to choose physics, maths, and psychology as my HL subjects, but I ended up choosing physics, maths, and economics because that is sort of like a path that has already been traveled upon, and that's a path that has been taken by people before me. But Even though psychology is a subject that I find myself greatly, greatly interested in, and economics was a subject that I have studied. In fact, both of us are in the same class. So like we like often we do things. We tend to sort of make things easier for ourselves and not try and challenge ourselves that way. But I think that's also related to the, again, coming back to the curriculum that we're in essentially the curriculum becomes a thing that you sort of have to do. And like that, it's like a to-do list thing where you click, you check, you want to check it and as soon as possible and try and move on to something that you enjoy more. And in doing so, the individual components of it, even though they interest you a lot, you'll try and simplify them and make the whole process easier, not realizing that you're taking away the value that it tries to bring to you. And in sort of that compromise between trying to get it done as soon as possible and doing justice to your interests, we end up losing track of what the values of that curriculum are. And yeah, in that, I think when you bring up the point of sort of being challenging yourself through by acknowledging your own sort of limits, I think that's very important.
So again, now that we're talking about, I believe, like taking value from the thing that you're doing and not just trying to get it done, how about we shift the conversation to leadership? So I know that for a fact that I've seen also that leadership sometimes is a thing which is to be completed again when you're thinking from a college-centric mindset. And sometimes people don't try to take value from the process itself, and instead just try to have it as another tick mark in the journey to college or something that they have to complete, a ritual of sorts to prove themselves worthy. But so when we're talking about those kind of leadership positions, what sort of values do you think that those really help students with? And like, how is it taxing for students? Does it force them to change themselves in ways which they wouldn't have? Does it enforce themselves? What do you think about what leadership does to students in general, especially when they're at such a important time in their high school lives?
Yeah, I have always, ever since my sort of beginning years of like formative years in school, I've always aspired to attain a leadership position in school and in our school. And like, I know you, like, since both of us have essentially grown up together, you're aware of the things both of us have undertaken in trying to be who we are, essentially. I know it sounds like both of us have achieved a lot. We've achieved a lot in our lives, but this is just speaking from experience. I think leadership positions, like when you ask me, do they make you change in a way you would not have? I believe that even though it's a taxing thing, it is a very, very, very important step in a person's growth as a person, like as a person's growth on multiple levels. Like, for example, I am the house captain of Kashmir House in my school, and I don't want to make this about the Doon School, but essentially this is sort of just talking about the examples that I've faced there, wherein in being a house captain, but you know, still facing sort of helplessness or feeling that you can't really drive the change that you wanted to drive because of the fact that we're not in school and we're doing things online and it's so hard to connect with people online. It makes it extremely hard because leadership often often takes place on a macro level, wherein you lead a group of people. And the group isn't there anymore because online, all of us are our own individual people. We're our individual email IDs. We're our individual we have our own individual identities. We're separated from each other. But in being together as a group physically, it's just the concept of concepts of sociology sort of almost let us know that once you're in a group, it's once people are together, it's much easier to lead them. And I think that is something that has been extremely taxing for the both of us, because both of us are prefects and both of us understand that it's been hard to try and implement new things, knowing that it's extremely hard to, first of all, attain feedback, because the people aren't there with you physically. So even if you go wrong, they've logged out of the meeting already and you have no one to sort of bounce your ideas back off. And secondly, it's also connecting with them on like a level, because the mere physical presence of a person can often be something that is very that makes leadership easy. But again, I think leadership isn't essentially about making it easy or doing things in a manner that is easy. Having a leadership position, trying to drive change, all of these things, as cliched and as like buzzword-esque they may sound, they are extremely important for a person's growth. And I think in the pursuit of these leadership positions and posts and in the pursuit of power, it's very, very easy to lose track of why you're going to that position. Because often, so I'll just trying to personalize this. I was, so just for the people who are listening to this right now and are not aware of how the school captain is elected in the Dune School, there is a democratic process that takes place where there's a vote that takes place, and then the person who gets the majority vote amongst the three candidates that have been nominated gets elected as the school captain. So I was lucky enough to be in that category of people, and essentially, like, I did not win that election, but still, the process of going from okay, I think I'll be someone who is up there, and then at the end where you sort of don't get it, in that process, I often sort of reflected upon times when I had gone from, I really want to drive change and I really want to do something that that creates a better school community or creates a better community around me and a more respectful community, to, oh, I want to give that speech, or, oh, I want to be in power. And it's very easy to do that. And I've often tried to correct myself, and I've gone to those sort of place, like gone to that place in my head. But then again, and sort of that sort of struggle is very, very taxing in that. And I think even Mayank, you would know, because even when, like, even in your sort of role that you play for the house, and the role that you play for the school, the various leadership positions that you have, I'm sure you have had a lot of struggles, and I'm sure a lot of it has been taxing for you. And essentially that is what sort of tests your mantle as a person who is, you know, if whether or not you'll be able to be in the public eye and be open to criticism, and being open to, you know, facing all of the sort of criticism that is at you, because leadership is as much about responsibility as it is about power and as it is about control, wherein there are two sides to it, and really the power approach and the ruling approach is the approach that you would not want to take, because it is not sustainable, and that is what makes it taxing. Because you're often people who look at leadership as something that is inherently related to power can find it taxing, because they're always insecure about people undermining their power. Whereas if people look at leadership as something of a responsibility, they have something to prove, and they have some people to sort of set an example to, and, you know, some people to look at and be like, okay, I am going to take responsibility for this particular thing, and I expect you guys to come along with me, because at the end of the day, all of us are in this together, right? So I think it's very taxing in that way, and I'm sure you have something to add to that.
Yeah, so when you were in the beginning, you talked about a little bit about how these leadership positions are, like, how do I put this? They're taxing in a way which you would not expect, and when you're talking about like the you talk about the physicality of it, like how when you're talking to people in person and the troubles with leading online virtually. So I understand that part especially well, because I do believe that the feedback cycle doesn't need to be words and paragraphs and proper conversations with people. The feedback cycle, from what I've seen, is often just very simple observations. So you, once you, if you, as a leader, if you made a decision or something, you can see the effects of that decision and how it bodes with people just by their faces or by how they act after that. And being there, having a physical presence definitely helps 110%, because obviously you are able to see all those things happening. It is quite taxing in the way that then you need to always keep an eye out, like, that if the decision that you're making, it's working well. But then I believe that also depends on your style of leadership. So, for example, from what I can see, like, your style of leadership, you want to ensure that people like get what they should be getting, but also like the right thing happens, the right thing occurs at the right time, that people don't start fooling around and everything. So, but for people such as who look at leadership as a position of power and power only, for them, then it's not about the responsibility, it's not about control, but it's more about assurance and stability of their selves, not stability of the community as a whole. So in that scenario, then I guess my question in itself, it does not work that well, because depending on what your leadership style is, it can or cannot be taxing for you. Because if you're exercising the power too much, it might be enjoyable for you, because everyone's coming to you for everything and you have control over everything, and that might be something that you enjoy. But if there's someone who is not so open to talking all the time and does not enjoy people intruding on his space all the time, then for them, they might enjoy the power to an extent, but again, it'll be too much of a nuisance for them to actually understand. So no matter what sort of leadership style that you have, the leadership system taxes you in some way or another eventually. Although how it taxes you might be very different. That's what I was getting when, that's what I was thinking when I was listening to you speak about all this. Would you like to say anything, or should we move on to the next question?
Yeah, I mean, just a little thing. I think the way you framed it was perfect in saying that the leadership style really sort of is something that can be pointed to when we look at people who, you know, look at leadership as a position of power or a position of responsibility. And I think it really is about who you are as a person. And by the way, just like none of these, like neither of these sort of styles of leadership are wrong, because anything being wrong is something extremely subjective. So for a person who does enjoy it as a position of power, I'm sure that it's the right thing to do for them. But for me, it's just not it. So like neither of these techniques are wrong, but the way you choose to lead people around you, the way you choose to interact with people around you, is extremely representative of what your own individual values are and how you would want to be treated if you were a person who was being led by someone. So yeah.
Yes. So let's bring an end to that part of the conversation. And for the last question of the day, we're going to try and talk about something a little more related to the values that you talked about as a person. So I know, Keshav, you like to, you identify yourself as a feminist, and you enjoy like discussions on it. And I've had a few discussions with you on it. So I have one question for you here, which I believe you suggested it yourself that we should talk about this, is that why do you think there's a stigma around the word feminism, and why do men try to distance themselves from the movement?
It's just, I feel like as a feminist, that is something that I have always thought about, and like specifically as a male feminist who is a part of an all boys boarding school, where I've tried to sort of talk about feminism to people and try and sort of ask them how things are and why do they or why don't they support the movement, and and things of that sort. And really, I've had a lot of observations. There are a lot of observations that I've made through those discussions. Now, before I begin with my sort of opinion on feminism, I think something that is very, very important for all people who are listening to this to understand is that, for me, being a feminist is being a supporter of gender equality. That's the whole notion of the letters F E N M fem being a part of it, and then people sort of categorizing it as something that is solely meant for women and is women centric is wrong, because according to me, because feminism in a lot of ways is extremely helpful for men, and is in a lot of ways just better for the society that we're in, and that is, and again, so like moving on to the observations that I've had, people usually, those who say that they're part of the feminist movement and they are feminists, those who cite reasons such as, oh, I have a sister, so I'm a feminist, or like, oh, I have a mother, so I'm a feminist, that is not a reason to be a feminist. Like, sure, I have a sister, I have a mother, and in sort of thinking about the day-to-day things, that day-to-day sort of incidents that they go through, and the things that, and the minor sort of the minor cases, things that seem to be minor for us, like those sort of cases, the things that we've normalized, when you start thinking about those things and you question those things, that is when having a sister or having a mother or having any sort of female that you observe these things happening to, that is when it becomes a valid reason to, you know, think about feminism, because that is when you really understand the way we've just been trained to, you know, just normalize what is happening around us. So even if, let's say, at 3 a.m. or 2 a.m. in the night, your parents are in their room and you go outside and you see that your mom is, you know, trying, getting something for your dad to eat, and you ask your mom what's happening, and then you're like, okay, your dad was feeling a little hungry, so I just went to grab some food for him. So and that is all right, that's fine by me. But if that is something that has been designated as a role for her, is the distinction that I would like to point out in something that is considered oppression and something that is just being treated equally. So it shouldn't be a designated thing for her to do. Something that only she does in the house, or something that can only be done by her because she is a female. I think often the reason why men distance themselves from the movement is that they are is the culture that we've created in being masculine and in being, you know, like feminism talks a lot about toxic masculinity, and in society's stereotypical notion of masculinity, we're often sort of forced to, you know, suppress our emotions and be the person who drives and be the person who is, you know, protecting the family and is the breadwinner and all of those sort of, you know, extremely masculine things to do. Those things essentially provide the sense of power to men in their sort of fake or toxic masculinity that they have adopted. And when you support them up to that level where, you know, it's not something like, okay, a man needs to protect the family and he's the breadwinner. And when the responsibilities are shared by a man and a woman, then that is true feminism. But in sort of that transition of power, almost, men get insecure about their power, and they get insecure about the sort of extremely toxic masculinity, idea of masculinity that they have, And that is why I say feminism is extremely important for men as well, because in being a feminist, I've seen myself being able to express a lot more, having the freedom to express a lot more, in understanding that things like cooking, things like, you know, putting nail paint on, or things like, you know, dressing a certain way or putting makeup on, that is not something that needs to be considered masculine or feminine. It is just something that people do. And it is a matter of choice for them. Feminism is not something that is, you know, curtailing the power that has been accorded to men. It is about trying to afford that power to all of society and trying to bring about a certain kind of freedom to do whatever you want through your choice. It just happens to be that through years and years of oppression, we've reached a point where women don't enjoy the same amount of freedom that men do, and that is where a society needs to get rid of this idea of, okay, I'm insecure about my power, because that power isn't meant to, that excess power that you have isn't meant to be yours. And by the way, there is no transition of power. It's not like there is this law of conservation of power. Power can be afforded to anyone without getting rid of, without, you know, giving up your own. So everyone has their rights. Everyone is needs to be equally treated and needs to be at a level where, you know, where you can truly understand the freedom that you need to afford to people of our community in order to do things that they want to do without the fear of being tagged as without the fear of being tagged as masculine or feminine. And that insecurity is what drives men to distance themselves from the moment.
Really well said, Keshav. Like, while you were speaking, I couldn't help but draw some parallels with some stuff which we had talked about previously in our conversation about leadership styles and about how certain leadership styles need to accord the juniors, those under them, some amount of freedom that to understand that they are not being undermined. And I couldn't help but draw parallels between how, like, you could argue that as of right now, feminism is such an issue because obviously there's clearly not inequality between the two races. So in that scenario right now, the one race which people do say is dominant, the male race, needs to again understand that sort of undermining their power is not being undermined the entire time, and that they can lift the entire community up together. And I think that whole point of working together is the main message which needs to be spread across. Do you think that's right? Because obviously you would understand this topic a lot more than I do.
Yes, I think that's essentially what we would want to happen. I mean, I remember reading about this research done by this person. His name is Adam Galinsky. And he talks about how gender differences and the sort of imbalance and disparity that we've created are essentially just power differences in disguise. And he draws this analogy he's come up with this concept of the range of acceptable behavior. And he talks about how men and women have different ranges of acceptable behavior defined by society. So if a woman exceeds that range of appropriate behavior, she's considered as someone who is rowdy and is someone who is a rebel and is someone who should be, you know, trying to push down and, you know, just force down. Whereas if she is below that range of acceptable behavior, people think of her as weak and someone who needs to be protected. And you know, just being taken care of. But the only issue is that is only because their range of acceptable behavior is a lot smaller than men's range of acceptable behavior. I mean, and you can see that in so many places wherein if you're sitting at a family gathering, you will notice that it'll like your a little like a little tug on your sister's shirt, or a little or like a little look of the eye to some other female in the circle, and she will, you know, like again try and adjust the way they're sitting. And like these little things are pointed out, like little actions, like okay, you should be sitting a certain way, or you should be acting a certain way. Whereas a lot of men, in their idea of, you know, being masculine, will, you know, like spread their chest and sit like and sit with their legs wide open, without any care of without any care for what personal space they need to provide to other people. And again, so this is just an example of the range of acceptable behavior that we talk about. And if anyone is like talking about, okay, so how, like you were saying that you know, feminism helps men as well, and but how, like you can talk about that in theory, but how does it happen on a practical level? Taking things on a very like in a very economic sense, can you imagine, Mayank, how many trade unions would gain bargaining power if they were not gender specific? How many trade unions would or how many labor unions would have that sort of, you know, would have greater backing if they included both genders? And this is true for both sides of the spectrum. An only female centric trade union would not work as well as a co-ed trade union, and the same can be said for a simply male trade union, simply because there will be more people. Here we're talking about people who are a part of who are a part of that trade union. Another example could be, you know, again relating to the expression of emotion and how things are at that point. And again, these are ideas that we need to familiarize ourselves with and need to really, really think deeply upon, because the way our community looks at being feminine or being masculine, with like air quotes around them, is not something that is right, because actions in themselves are meant to be individualistic. They're meant to be personal. They're meant to be subjective. They vary on like a person to person basis. They're not meant to be categorized. They're not categorical. And in doing that, we start creating this disparity and we start polarizing the community. And that is not just with the male and female spectrum, but that is also what we're seeing on the basis of race. That is also what we're seeing on the basis of religion, on the basis of caste at times as well. So again, the power difference is essentially power and the privilege that it brings along with it. That disparity is what is fundamental to the reason why men try to distance themselves from this movement.
You've touched upon a lot of different points throughout our conversation today, and I think with this question we've come to a close where we've related both the leadership and mental health aspect of things to also feminism in a certain way, although in a very limited capacity, but in a certain way we've also connected that. So there's some interesting insights about economics also driving those things, and I'm sure that we can have a conversation later on in the future regarding this, but for today that's going to be all. Thank you so much for coming to talk to me, Keshav. It's been a pleasure having you here on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Mayank. If I can just like take a few minutes of your time again, I would just like to say that this is such a great medium that you've afforded to people to, you know, express their ideas. And I don't like getting all sappy, especially in front of my own friends. But I really want to say that I'm a person who's a big fan of, you know, discussing ideas and discussing thoughts, and you know, expressing, providing people a platform to again express their ideas. Being a writer, being a debater, being a public speaker, it is just something that I have grown up doing, and I think this podcast will give a lot of people that particular platform. I remember Denzel Washington said this once, that I'm sure he quoted this from someone else, but he said that small minds discuss people, good minds discuss goals and great minds discuss ideas or something like that. And I think you're providing people a platform to, you know, develop themselves, a great set of mind. So that's all I have to say. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for the kind words.